Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Francine Foss, Anish Chagpar, and Stephen Gore. Dr. Foss is a professor of medicine in the section of medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the breast center at Smilow Cancer Hospital. And Dr. Gore is director of hematological malignancies at Smilow. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can submit questions and comments to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. This week, you'll hear a conversation about colorectal cancer with Dr. Xavier Lohr. Dr. Lohr is medical director of the Colorectal Cancer Prevention Program and co-director of the Smilow Cancer Genetics and Prevention Program. Here's Dr. Stephen Gore.
Could you tell us a little bit about what you do here at Yale and about colorectal cancer?
Sure. So here I'm co-director of the Cancer Genetics and Prevention Program in the Smilow Cancer Center. And I'm also the medical director of the Colorectal Cancer Prevention Program here. So with this role, I'm working on increasing colon cancer screening rates and also in basically integrating the different services that the Smilow Cancer Center and the Yale New Haven Hospital do offer for families who have an increased risk of colorectal cancer.
So who should be screened for colorectal cancer?
So it does depend on your family history. So there's no recipe that fits everyone. In general, average risk individuals are individuals who do not have any family members who have had colorectal cancer. In this case, for the majority of people, it will be age 50. But we have good evidence that in African Americans, we need to start colorectal cancer screening before that age, probably by age 45, as some societies have already recommended, because they do develop colorectal cancer at much earlier age.
Hmm. And what is involved in screening? Is it colonoscopy, or do we do stool fecal blood? Or
sure. So we have we call the non-invasive and the invasive modalities. The invasive modalities is basically based on colonoscopy, using a flexible tube to inspect the entire colon. That's the most widely used screening test in the U.S. The advantage is it allows us to visualize the entire colon and also to intervene, so when we see polyps, which are usually the origin of colon cancers, we can remove them on the spot, decreasing the risk of colon cancer development. The other options are the or the stool-based options, which is basically they are most of them looking at the presence of occult blood in the stool, as most tumors, particularly as they grow, do shed some blood that often we don't see on the naked eye, but it can be detected through those tests. So those tests are usually quite good, actually, at detecting advanced cancers, not so good at early cancers and polyps, as they do not bleed as much.
Hmm. I remember a few years ago, people were talking about the use of some kind of a CT scan colonoscopy. Am I making that up?
Or? No, you're not. CT colonography, and basically that's based on doing a CT scan with special software techniques that allows us for detection of polyps. The challenges with the CT colonography have been, number one, is that there's a significant number of polyps that do not grow towards the lumen, but they grow towards inside the mucosa, which is something that's harder to see, but still most of the time we can see it on colonoscopy. And those are very difficult to see on CT colonography. So those cases are harder to see. And also we have an issue about the size of the polyps that can be detected. In general, small polyps may not be detected. What that means is unclear, because some polyps, we do know that they actually do not progress into cancer. But still, there are some questions that need to be answered before CT colonography is generalized. So at this point, there are developments in terms of developing new software tools for this, and probably we'll hear more about it. But for now, it's not a preferred method of colon cancer screening.
So it sounds like when you're 50, go ahead and get your colonoscopy.
That's definitely always the message. And it is the message because we have enough studies that show us over and over that colon cancer screening does decrease incidence and mortality from colon cancer. And screening in colon cancer has been one of the big successes over the last few years in the U.S., as we've seen the incidence going down in a very steady way, and for the most part linked to this screening, the adoption of screening techniques and the generalization of the screening methods.
Yeah, I think some of our audience may be concerned about how frequently they're going to need to have this test, which even if it's not a terrible test, you know, it's a nuisance in terms of the preparation a couple of days before. So in your average risk middle-aged person, how often do they need to have the screening colonoscopy?
So in general, if the individual does have a colonoscopy, does not have a single polyp, the preparation was good, so we feel confident, we've seen everything, and the person does not have any family members with colon cancer, we go and we say that we can wait for 10 years. Because we do have quite a high degree of confidence that for the most part or the majority of colon cancers do develop very, very slow. And individuals who've never developed a polyp at age 50, the percentage that will end up developing polyps in the future is also lower. When we have some family members who have colon cancer, when we've already have had polyps removed from the colon, the next colonoscopy will be tailored according to these different factors.
I see. And you said that one of your jobs here is to increase the prevalence of colon cancer screening. What kinds of action are you or your team taking to increase the uptake of colonoscopy in Connecticut?
Sure. So what we see here in Connecticut and in most places is that there's a huge disparity in terms of the intake of colon cancer screening as more screening methods too, according to different racial groups. And we do know that African Americans do get less screened, and even less screened Hispanics. Hispanics is the group that gets less screened for colon cancer. So we really want to focus on increasing the screening in this particular populations that are less screened than in the white non-Caucasian or Caucasian population, actually. And in order to do that, we've started several initiatives. One of them is a collaboration with the Fairhaven Community Health Center that basically streamlines the process of getting their patients to come and get their colonoscopies done here. Some of them are underinsured or not insured at all, and we facilitated this process. So actually, we are providing the service and hopefully increasing screening rates and decreasing colon cancer in the most vulnerable populations. And we really want to expand on that.
Do you think that the financial piece, lack of insurance or underinsurance, is the primary barrier to get to screening? Or is there any, I'm sure there must be an education piece. Is there any piece of mistrust about coming to a place like Yale?
I think there's a little bit of everything. There are studies, well-done studies, that consistently show that number one cause of this disparity is truly an insurance-related issue. So that's extremely important, and it's nice to hear that we've made so much progress in enrolling individuals to the new health exchanges. But also there's this cultural issue that you are mentioning that we really need to work on. And for instance, what we're doing with the Fairhaven Clinic is that's heavily attended by Hispanic individuals. We've streamlined the process where we are providing all the instructions and the entire process in Spanish, so they can actually overcome this barrier, at least if it's a language barrier. So it will take not only to get more individuals insured, but also to put all the proper tools together to really overcome all these limitations. But we really need to work in different fronts.
How are these programs paid for? Do we get grants from the state? Or?
Actually, the Fairhaven Yale initiative is being paid by a grant by the American Cancer Society. We obtained this grant a couple of months ago, And it's one of the three grants in the entire country that's basically directed at increasing the collaboration of large academic institutions with community clinics, so we can streamline the process of or facilitate the screening of those individuals. The ACS is very interested in seeing us succeed, as they would see this as a pilot program for other institutions around the country to increase screening rates. So we're really hopeful we'll get good numbers here, and we'll get a lot of individuals screened, and therefore they'll see this as a model to translate it to other areas in the U.S. Show that there are ways to do it.
I assume you'll have to show them some deliverables that you've actually done the work and delivered the goods.
Absolutely. So we need to show them that we are capable to provide to increase the screening rates of the eligible individuals that usually attend that clinic. That we do it within a reasonable amount of time, because time is of essence, and being a screening test. If we are not, if we're presented with options that are so far down in time, probably we forget and we get less motivated. So we're working on decreasing the time of the waiting time for individuals to get their colonoscopies done, and to really engaging them in truly actually coming and getting their procedures done. And also very important, working very hard on making sure people prepare well. We have a big problem, which is a lot of individuals, unfortunately, are unable to complete their preparations, and we don't see well. And if we don't see well, we may be missing on small cancers, and therefore, it's very important that we work hard on educating, so we are all better prepared. And we, when gastroenterologists do the procedures, they are confident that they've seen the entire colon. So those are different aspects that we need to work on to make colon cancer screening successful.
And are you hands-on in this yourself? Do you go out to the community to talk? Or
correct. We have started this. The first that we've done is a series of talks to the primary providers. And that's where we have started, and we are going to spread that out. Because we are helping in implementing the system within the clinic itself, so it does not become another burden to the primary care provider. They are already burdened with a lot of information. Most of the time, they have to cover the acute sickness of what individuals come with to these clinics. Therefore, adding an extra step, which is explaining about the importance of colon cancer screening and other screening modalities, is important. So we need to make it easy and for them, so actually the patients can get the message while we are still able to provide all the services. And again, most of these clinics are very stranded by patient care. They need to deliver a lot of care to a lot of individuals. We have to make sure that when they engage into that, it does not become yet an extra burden and yet still increase the rates.
Yeah, I guess in some of these underserved communities, the usual operating mode for patients is to come in only when you're sick, and the whole idea of preventive care is probably not as common as we wish it would be, I suppose.
Exactly. So they really have to make a big effort in tagging along the preventive component when patients do present there with their any acuteness, because as you mentioned, the level of awareness about preventive measures is just not as common there. Therefore, they really have to be very smart about developing these skills and making sure that when they have their captive audience, when the patient shows up there for whatever reason, they are all over the place, making sure that we do take care of the patient, and that includes preventive measures.
Well, that's great. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and certainly want to come back to your work on both screening and genetics.
Smoking can be a very strong habit that involves the potent drug nicotine, and there are many obstacles to face when quitting smoking. But smoking cessation is a very important lifestyle change, especially for patients undergoing cancer treatment. Quitting smoking has been shown to positively impact response to treatments and to decrease the likelihood that patients will develop second malignancies. Smoking cessation programs are currently being offered at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center and at Smilow Cancer Hospital Yale New Haven. The Smoking Cessation Service at Smilo operates on the principles of the U.S. Public Health Service Clinical Practice Guidelines. All treatment components are evidence-based, and therefore all patients are treated with FDA-approved first-line medications and smoking cessation counseling. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore. We're talking tonight about colorectal cancer, in particular disparities in colorectal screening, and also the genetics of colon cancer. Dr. Gore, before the break, we were talking about how you're working to increase uptake of screening in underserved communities, which is, you know, really, really wonderful work. I know that you also are interested in cancer genetics. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. So colon cancer, along with breast cancer, is among the group of common cancers, the one with where a genetic component has been more often been implicated in cancer development. We know that about 15% of the individuals who develop colon cancer, they have another first-degree relative who also had a colon cancer. And those individuals in those families do have 2 to 3 times increased risk of colon cancer. On the other hand, we know that there are some particular genes that when they are mutated, they predispose to the very high risk of colon cancer. This is what we call syndromic cases. And in those are inherited, and they are inherited one generation after another. And in those cases, the risk of developing colon cancer is extremely high, much, much higher than the average risk population. And we do need to take special care and attention to those families and individuals.
So how would I know if I'm in a colon cancer family? Is it just enough that I had an aunt who had colon cancer? Is there a certain frequency that should ring a bell for me? What should worry people?
So in general, having several, not only one, but several family members with colon cancer and other types of cancer, because many of the syndromes we're talking about, individuals do develop different types of cancers, not only colon cancer. Having that just a few or just one first-degree relative who developed that cancer at a pretty significant young age, in general put a cutoff of age 50, but we see cases much younger. When we see something like this, we should be aware, and certainly we should seek for a genetic evaluation to see if those are risk factors that really put us in a category that would make it suspicious for one of these syndromes.
Hmm. So I imagine a lot of people see their internist or primary care physician or nurse practitioner, and if they're doing a thorough job, they often take a family history, and so let's just say, I bring up, these various cancers in my family. Do you find that most primary care practitioners are able to make a transition to a genetics referral? Is that what it would be, a consultation?
Right. I think that is also a big challenge, and that's one of the aspects we're working very hard on. As we were mentioning before, primary care providers are stranded with so much to take care of. And while family history forever and ever has been a very important aspect of our family, of our history taking, when we see a patient, it does take a lot of time. And we know that we are not the best at taking good family histories, again, most of the time because of time constraints. Therefore, I think it's key, and we're working on that in developing tools that facilitate that process too. And one of the tools that we are planning on implementing is a questionnaire that patients will fill them up by themselves, and that will be turned into the clerks, and the clerks will pass it on to our services, so we would spot out who would benefit from genetics consultation. And this way, we don't put much more burden in the primary care physician, yet individuals can have the risk assessment and be called on when that's appropriate. We're also working on implementing two online tools so individuals from home can fill up this information, and that could be passed along, and that could be also that could facilitate this screening. So there are different ways of doing it, and we are working on those because we do recognize that this is challenging, and often individuals do not remember if we don't really prompt them to start thinking about who may have died or who may have had cancer in the family. So those tools should also help individuals to dig in a little bit in their family histories and see if there's anything that can be suspicious for a syndromic case.
Hmm. So if I were to be referred to a cancer genetic specialist, what would happen in such a consultation?
So basically, the first thing is gathering this family pedigree with all this information about family members and potential cancers or other conditions, skin conditions, or other things that actually may make you think that they have a particular syndrome. You would also look at if they already had cancer, the type of cancer they had, because some of these syndromic cases are associated more commonly with some types of features, because not all cancers are alike. Therefore, you gather all this information and you come up with a risk assessment that we call it, basically, that gives you a rough estimate on the risk of that individual and family to have a syndromic case. With that, if we believe that the family is has a significant risk for having that syndrome, then there are some tests, and some of them are genetic tests, where we can look for mutations in the genes that can be causing these cancers. So we can go through the full process. Or on the other hand, we can reassure that actually does not look like that's a syndromic case, and have the patients reassured and not undergoing any genetic testing. But the risk assessment is key. It does take time. It needs to be done by individuals who are familiar with that and proceed accordingly.
So what happens if I find out that I have a mutation in one of these genes that's associated with a familial cancer syndrome? Now I'm going to be like scared to death, I guess.
Right. And I think for the most part, years back, that was the thing. I'm going to learn about it. I'm going to learn that I'm going to develop all these cancers. So what can we do about it? All I'm going to do is I'm going to be scared all my life. So
right.
I think that the difference is that knowing that there are some preventive measures that can be undertaken and discussed with the patient that can actually, that they've been shown to prevent cancers and save lives. And we know now that because it's been a few years since we've been learning about all these different genes that cause these syndromes and studying these families and the kind of interventions that we can do to spare lives. So certainly we can be very proactive, because being proactive does prevent cancer and save lives. Therefore, it's a matter of doing the right thing, because it will spare you from further problems. Not only you are not only going to get the psychological stress, but actually you can get a little bit of peace of mind that knowing that you have that, there are things that we can do that can minimize the risk of developing cancer.
Mm-hmm. And what kinds of things does that involve?
So, for instance, in one of the common colon cancer syndrome, which is Lynch syndrome, the risk of endometrial cancer is pretty high. It's up to 40%. It varies depending on the gene that's mutated. In those cases, very often we discuss individuals who have already passed the childbearing age about the option of hysterectomy, because there are studies that have shown that it does prevent cancers and does save lives. So that's an option, because most of the time those cancers do develop at a later age, and therefore for the most part they may keep their endometrium until childbearing age is passed and then undergoes hysterectomy. Undergoing more frequent colonoscopies is also very effective. And there are also some medications that, for instance, in syndromes that are called polyposis syndromes, where individuals not only develop colon cancer, but develop a lot of polyps, some of them end up being developing cancer. There are some medications actually that can decrease the polyp burden. And they are being used when part of the colon is taken out, but the rest is still left in place. And, of course, we'll hear more about more medications preventing or working on preventing colon cancer. And, again, one of the old friends, aspirin, we know that it does prevent colon cancer. And when we put all the benefits and risks together, we should evaluate in many cases if it's worth placing a patient in aspirin for prevention purposes too. So even some simple, not very well-known old friends like aspirin may play a role here too.
And are you using full-dose aspirin or baby aspirins? Or?
So it looks like baby aspirin probably is doing the same work as the full-dose aspirin.
Yeah, so it's good for our coronary arteries and it's good for our colons.
Right.
So that's great. Now, are you always able to detect an abnormal gene in these particular families?
So we've made a lot of progress, and many different genes have been identified over the last 15 years or so, and certainly it's been the progress has been dramatic. But we believe that there's still some cases where we just don't find a mutation, and they look like they're certainly syndromic because you see different family members affected and different generations. So it still it looks like there are some significant number of cases that we do not have the mutations detected, and there's active research in that field to trying to figure out more of the genes that can be implicated in colon cancer development.
Mm-hmm. So are you studying these patients' genomes or?
Certainly. So the new generation of technologies for genetic testing has been there's been an explosion on those what it's called a high throughput whole genome sequencing or exome sequencing, which is basically allowing us to screen entire genes and genomes in a very fast and easy way in comparison to what we used to do just 10 years ago or something like this. That's allowed us to really move forward with those cases and studying these families where we can still see mutations. So I think we'll hear more, and the pace of discovery still is accelerating just because these tools have dramatically increased our capacity and our power to make more and new discoveries.
I know a few years ago, people were concerned about these genetic discoveries and subjecting themselves to genetic study because of the concern that if they were to be found to have a syndrome or any kind of abnormal gene, that perhaps their insurance would be adversely affected. Do you have any sense for how now with the Affordable Care Act, has that been impacted? Do you know?
So before the Affordable Care Act, there's a new federal law that's called GINA that was implemented several years ago. And many states actually have their own laws that protect against discrimination because of being a carrier or having a syndrome. We have seen no cases in the courts, and I believe that we have not seen any of those yet. Probably we won't see them because GINA has already been in effect for a while, and that it's very specific at prohibiting discrimination because of that. So that really gives us a peace of mind. And also let us be more open with other healthcare providers sharing the information because it will all result in better healthcare for the patients who are affected.
Well, that's very reassuring for our patients, I'm sure, who have been concerned. I know that mm-hmm. it's something that comes up in my practice. People are very concerned about the implications for their insurance. Thank you for that. So in your work in the various, I'd like to go back to a little bit of your disparities work. In your work in the various various underserved communities, do you find that the characteristics of the cancer are pretty much the same across communities?
Sure. So there are significant differences that we're trying to explain, and certainly one of the focus that we had is African Americans, because of their much higher risk or much higher incidence of colon cancer, and also a much higher death rate from colon cancer. And looking at specifically at African Americans, there are certain features that are quite different. One of them is that they develop a much higher number of right-sided or proximal tumors in the colon. And those are often more difficult to see on colonoscopy, more difficult to clean when patients are taking their preparations. And they also have features like often they invade inside the mucosa and are harder to see. That has a lot of implications for the African-American community, and they deserve further study.
Dr. Xavier Lores, Medical Director of the Colorectal Cancer Prevention Program and Co-Director of the Smilo Cancer Genetics and Prevention Program. We invite you to share your questions and comments. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archived programs are available in both audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support for this program. And we'd also like to thank Renee Gaudette, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center. I'm Bruce Barber, hoping you'll join us again next Sunday evening at 6 for another edition of Yale Cancer Center Answers here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.